You could tell how bad a geography teacher I was in primary
Yeah.
school. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that gives you a peek inside the minds of some truly inspirational teachers. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Sarah Larson. Hi, Sarah, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, you enjoying being back to school?
I am enjoying it. The summer holidays seems a very dim and distant memory, but it's always good to be back, isn't it? And meet your new classes. So yeah, no, it's all good. All good.
Excellent. Now, we always begin with our guests and numbers, get a feel for who they are, where they're from. And so my first question to you is years as a teacher.
This is my 26th year being a teacher, so I've hit quarter of a century, just over.
First year group taught?
So being secondary, I seem to remember in my very, very first year, to be fair, teaching in a school in Chislehurst, I think I only had years 7, 8, and 9, so just lower school. So no upper school in my very first year. And
Last year group taught?
actually, weirdly, I'm back to doing the same in a different school. But yeah, I've only got years 7, 8, and 9 on my timetable this year. So that's almost come full circle. Literally only just realised that sitting here.
Most important year group?
So that's a tough one because you could argue it's year 11 because that's the year in which they sit their GCSEs and there's a lot riding on that year for them and it's very pressurized for teachers and for students. But equally, I might also say year 7 because that's the year in which you can get them inspired, motivate them, shape them to a degree, and get them interested in your subject. So I think I would say both of those, but for very different reasons.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, we're quite interested in the teacher secondary school, but I don't think it's on my in my future at the
Year
moment.
7, not that I've ever taught primary, but year 7 feels like what I imagine primary teaching to be like. They are very different when they get to year 8. They grow up very rapidly, the hormones hit. Year 7 are yes, a little bit of a breed apart in a very nice way, but they're still very childlike in year 7.
I can imagine. Favorite year group?
Again, I love teaching year 11 simply because as a geography subject specialist, it gives me the chance to really, go in depth with my subject and to, it's quite satisfying from a selfish point of view, getting paid to stand and talk about the subject that you love, to a really high level and inspiring those to go on to potentially take it for A level is amazing. When a child comes up to you at the end of one of their lessons in year 11 and says, Miss, I'm thinking of doing this for A level. What do you think? Do you think I'd be capable? Just it's such a nice feeling when you know you've inspired them that much. But equally year 7, because they're so super keen, they like telling you things. They are inspired by the subject, they're fascinated by what we teach them. So again, it's quite hard to choose because it's both for different reasons, really.
I mean, both sound great. Both sound like great reasons. I think, yeah, I can. We have something similar in year six, where they talk about what they want to do in the future and stuff like that there. But I can imagine it's much more focused when your subject is what because they only have what
Yeah.
three, four choices when they go up onto A level. So yeah.
Yeah, 3 maximum of 4, but most at 3, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So out of all of those subjects, some colleges offer so many subjects. If they've picked geography and they've only got 3 choices, it's really satisfying when you've inspired them enough to have got them to that point. Yeah.
Blog posts at sarahlarson.school.blog.
So I had to look this one up. There's 14 sitting on there. I haven't put anything up for about a year actually, and I'm feeling the need to, it's not a geography specific site. It's more a cognitive science site, and in particular, kind of linked with verbal feedback because that is one of the big drums that I like to bang every now and again, trying to get schools to drop written marking. And I think I might need to go back to some blogging because I think that still needs to happen more in more schools, and I think there's more still to be said. So 14, but counting.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think some really interesting blogs showing your thought processes with different things. You mentioned Cog's Eye. There's one, maybe
Yeah.
two or three down there on the list that was it really stood out to me in that one.
Yes, and how it's changed my practice, and also kind of a practical guide to using visualizers as well. They've changed my practice, honestly. They have not just with geography teaching, but the giving of feedback as well, kind of live feedback and in the moment. So yeah, there's kind of a practical guide on there if anyone wants to have a look.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely should. And then the most important question, tweets.
So again, I had to look this up and I'm horrified, if that's the right word, I don't know, or surprised to see that it's 10,200. I don't know how you word that, so not being a mathematician, I guess it's 10,200, isn't it? That's what it's trying to tell me. 10,200.
I mean, I think that's probably mid-table. You know,
is it?
We go from the really low to the really high. I mean,
what's
one
the
day.
Highest you've had?
Oh, to test my memory. I mean, I think some forgets have been in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh,
perhaps.
Really? Oh, okay. All right. That's all right then. Yeah, I'll take mid-table. That's good.
What's really interesting is that all the time I've been doing this, mine don't seem to be going up that much at all. So
Oh no.
it must have been 2,000 in about 3 years.
You're just
So
more of a lurker than a poster.
yeah. The focus of this episode is going to center around geography. But tell us about your journey and how you got here.
So how I got to be the geography teacher that I am today.
Yeah, the professional you are today.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, I guess my love for geography was sparked by my own GCSE geography teacher, Mrs. Crocker. I don't know if she's still with us. She was fairly elderly when I had her, kind of 30, 35 years ago. She was just super enthusiastic. Her subject knowledge was amazing. And so I actually did way better at the GCSE than I thought I would. I got the top grade. And so I decided to carry on taking that at A-level with the same teacher, actually, because my school had a sixth form. So I kept the same teacher across there. She continued inspiring me. I decided I loved it enough to want to take it at degree level. And so that's what I did. I studied geography at Portsmouth University. And I came out with a BA, Bachelor of Arts in Human Geography. Then I kind of did a year not really knowing what I wanted to do. I did a bit of kind of temping here and there. And then I decided that actually I really wanted to do something that allowed me to still use my subject. And loads of my friends from my course were going off and doing all sorts of things with their geography degree that had not very much to do with geography. And teaching seemed the natural progression. So I trotted off to University of Swansea, or University of Wales at Swansea, and did my PGCE. And then I secured my first teaching job in Chislehurst, in London Borough of Bromley. That was just for 1 year. It was a 1 year contract. I then moved on to a school in East London, in Dagenham. I did that for 2 years. That was kind of very much an inner city school. It was hard work. The children there came from very underprivileged backgrounds. So that was a steep, steep learning curve working there. I then moved down to Surrey and the West Sussex area, took my job at Reigate School in the year 2000, and I've been there ever since. I absolutely adore the place, and they keep giving me new roles that it's impossible to say no to. So I'm still there. I've kind of moved into initial teacher training. We have a skit. So I have been the geography subject tutor. I've just let that role go because I was getting a little bit too busy with all the things I'd said yes to. But I'm also the link tutor for our side of the skit. So I now oversee the assessment and the quality assurance of the provision of the training that the student teachers get in their partnership schools in and around my school as well. So I've got my finger in a lot of pies, and I'm teaching quite a bit of RE this year as well. So I'm kept busy, but I think it's true to say that amongst everything that I do, geography teaching is my number one passion, I think, and always will be. So I do still have some of that on my timetable, I'm pleased to say. So a long and varied career, and I'm super busy at the moment, but I still love my geography. It's my number one love.
23 years. I mean, that's the kind of longevity you don't often see. Yeah. Doesn't seem to be built
there
into
are,
the culture.
There are staff there that have been there longer than me. It's a great school. Our head teacher started at our school as an NQT, and he's now the head. So I think that just goes to show, doesn't it, that when you find a great school with great staff and what have you, and students, people don't want to leave. So, yeah, no, love working there.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I mean, obviously retention's a big topic at the moment. I reckon people should come and see what's going right in Reigate. And,
come and have a look at Reigate School. We're doing a great job, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the religious education.
Yeah.
Is that, you have an interest in that? Or are you helping out?
I fell into it, if I'm honest. I was asked about 2 or 3 years ago if I would kind of plug a gap in the timetable, and would I do a straight move from RE to geography? Geography to RE. And would I drop all my geography teaching and move 100% into RE? And I said, you know what? I'm really happy to have been asked. Thank you. But I don't want to completely leave behind my geography teaching. So the deal was that I kept a little bit of geography, and I at the moment I'm mostly doing RE. But actually, you know, teaching a second subject and getting to grips with your subject knowledge has been quite a nice learning curve for me, and it's helped me see things from the trainee's point of view as well. When I'm, you know, making sure that their subject knowledge is secure, I know what it's like to be teaching a new subject and learning the subject knowledge as well as getting to grips with everything else. But it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. I'm teaching it up to GCSE. I'm really enjoying it, if I'm honest. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, it's a level of empathy you can't get anywhere else, you know, when you've gone through a similar experience recently.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And it's very different to the RE that I was taught, put it that way, 30 or so years ago. It's very much a kind of world views. You know, we all have a worldview. It might be an atheist worldview or a theist worldview, but we all have one. And you tend to get greater buy-in from the students that way because it's relevant to them that way, regardless of what their kind of beliefs are.
I mean, we could spend hours talking about that. But the focus is on geography.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a subject we have touched on before on the podcast, but really need to give it more attention. I mean, in my research ed talk, I tried to use a geography example when we were talking about variation theory. But I think it makes sense to start with definitions. What is geography?
It is, and this is not a cop-out, but it is very hard to kind of just give a one sentence definition. So my definition won't just be one sentence, not least because it's such a varied subject. So for example, you know, I might be teaching deindustrialization in Northeast England one minute, then I might be teaching about the geology of the UK, you know, rock types and etc. The next lesson, it's such a varied subject. But if we kind of try and hone it down to a definition, essentially it's the study of physical geography, so natural features and processes on the Earth's surface, but also looking at human features and human processes. So, you know, the jobs that people do, how they get around, how towns and cities and urban areas grow. And then it's the kind of link between those two disciplines, how the physical and the human interact. I guess you could call that environmental geography, but you could also think about how humans manage physical processes, how humans manage physical and natural hazards. You know, you've only got to look at, for example, the earthquake in Morocco at the weekend. How do people plan for that, prepare for it, and mitigate against it? So it's impossible really to look at just the physical and just the human in isolation. They interact at every single level, whether it be positively or negatively. So essentially, it's the study of physical and human and their interaction and the physical processes and the interactions between the two.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's really interesting you say that it's difficult to define in few words, because I think there's almost, you know, there's a big conversation about disciplinary knowledge. It feels to me as if the disciplinary knowledge you're drawing on is from many, many different disciplines. How does that
Absolutely.
Impact on your interpretation of things?
It does, because you can, you know, you can teach a lesson and the students will say, oh, Miss, we did this in science, you know, rock types, for example, or air pressure and the concept of, you know, warm air rising and what have you. Yeah, absolutely. They cover that in science. You might be doing something at GCSE level and you might say to the students, well, if you're doing business studies GCSE, you know, I want you to bring that knowledge in, because you might be looking at economies, for example, and, you know, inflation or deindustrialization. So there's, you know, maths, certainly at the new GCSE, the post 2016 GCSE with the new national curriculum reforms, there's a lot of maths in that new syllabus. And so that's testing my subject knowledge in that aspect as well, because there's a lot of what used to be in the old A level that's been brought down to GCSE level. You know, of course, English, they've got to be able to write coherently as well. You're right, there's an awful lot of disciplines that go together to make up the discipline of geography.
What are your guiding principles for the teaching of geography?
So, I mean, when I was thinking about this question, I think maybe what I need to just comment on is how geography's changed over time, just so we kind of know what geography is like in schools right now. So kind of in the 1950s and 60s, it used to be known as Capes and Bays geography, and just regional studies and just learning what were places like. What was the name of this capital city? What's the name of that bay and headland and what have you on a map? It was just learning about where places are. And then things moved on a bit into the 1980s, and it became about preparing children for the world of work and, you know, the rapidly growing economy in Britain at that time. People, certainly in the discipline of geography in the kind of 50s and 60s, were largely being ignored. It was all about facts and figures, but not about people's lived experience. But as we've moved into more recent times, people's experiences and what life is actually like on the ground for people in other countries is looked at far more. So the point where we're at today, I think, the guiding principles for teaching geography, I think as any teacher of any subject, what's really important is that your subject knowledge is up to scratch. You can't hope to do a good job teaching anything if your own subject knowledge isn't where it is. A knowledge of students' misconceptions that they might come to your lesson with, and they still throw me those misconceptions. Some of the things they come up with that they thought was true, that obviously isn't true. You know, I've had a student recently thinking genuinely that the moon was where Australia is, and that that's where you go if you go on a big holiday to Australia. You get in a space rocket and off you go up to the moon. I've had students think that, you know, rivers, for example, are man-made and they've been dug with shovels. So having a knowledge of what preconceptions students might come to your lesson with prior to teaching, I think, is crucial, because you can address those before they arise. But also, I think pertinent to geography, I've talked about how it's changed over time in terms of the approach of teaching the subject, but the subject itself changes so rapidly. I think it's one of the most rapidly changing subjects on our curriculum. I mean, I think there's, you know, there are others, but, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think maths changes too much, and possibly, you know, MFL, the language doesn't move on that much. But with geography, the case studies I'm teaching now, I'm teaching about, for example, how rapidly Nigeria's economy is growing, because it's a very, very relevant place to study within the context of Africa. 20 or 30 years ago, we wouldn't have taught that. There wasn't much going on there that was worthy of study. We have new natural disasters, for example, that we might want to build into our curriculum to keep it up to date. So, you know, we used to teach about the Lynmouth floods in the UK. It happened in the 1950s. It's just too out of date. The response that you would study that people put in place after that flood, it's not up to date. So we now teach about the Boscastle flood, and even that is nearly 20 years old. So, you know, you have to continuously, as a geography teacher, update your subject knowledge, because the world is moving on and your teaching needs to reflect that. So making sure that you don't have your own misconceptions as well, and outdated worldviews, you know, that things are rapidly developing in many African countries, for example. It's not the continent that it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Again, that wasn't a very concise answer, but I think in summary, excellent subject knowledge, keeping up with your subject knowledge, and I guess as well, just being able to inspire your students to have that sense of awe and wonder about the world around them and broadening their own horizons. And that might be talking to them about the geography of things that are relatively near to them, because there are some students that won't even have experienced that. And I've come across other teachers that have described, you know, students that, for example, live in deprived coastal towns that might live 2 miles from the seafront, who've never seen the sea because mum can't afford the bus fare, too many children to cope with walking, it's just too far. You know, the horizons of some of our students are so narrow that I think that is a crucial, crucial role that geography teachers have to play.
Absolutely. I mean, we used to go on a train journey to the beach every year, because you were hitting two things that, despite living so close to London and so close to the train line, our children had never been there, and they'd never, and
yeah,
obviously the north coast of Kent is essentially stony beaches from one side to the other, isn't it? And
yes, I'm
totally with you on that one.
Yeah. It's a whole kind of cultural capital discussion, isn't it? That the level of cultural capital, I mean, having said that, you can have a class of 30 and you've got children that go on walking, you know, jaunts every weekend with their parents, and their parents talk to them about what they see while they're out. And then you've got other children, and I've genuinely had this as well, that have no idea what you mean when you say, you know, put the news on tonight, children, have a look at what they're talking about, because there's a big news story. I've had a boy put his hand up and say, Miss, what's the news? What is it? I don't know what that word means. And so the vast range of cultural capital, or lack of, that you might have in front of you is quite tricky to navigate sometimes, because you don't know. You don't know what they don't know until you kind of get to know them.
I mean, you mentioned subject knowledge, and obviously geography, one of those subjects that maybe quite a few primary teachers are more likely to have studied. You know, the foundation subjects are normally quite popular, I think, you know, because I think you've got less than 3% of primary teachers will have studied maths beyond GCSE, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think subject knowledge is still something that we can always aspire to improve. Where should we go if we want to improve our geography knowledge?
So what I would definitely recommend is looking at the materials that the Geographical Association have on their website. I mean, you can pay for membership, it gives you access to a whole range of things. But I think I'm right in saying that there's a whole lot of free stuff on there as well. The primary aim of the Geographical Association is to support teachers and geography teachers, and that includes at primary. And actually, there's a lot on there for primary teachers because they recognise that often it won't be their subject specialism and they need that extra support. They do a 3-day conference every Easter as well, and there's quite a few primary teachers that will go to that along with secondary teachers. There's the Royal Geographical Society, which is a bit more of a general kind of organisation for just people that are interested in geography. They do Monday night lectures, which are available online if you're a member as well. So you can sit and watch those in the comfort of your own home. They've got a whole load of teaching resources on there for teachers as well. There are lots of kind of blogs, and I think a lot of the Oak National Academy lessons have been taken off, haven't they? But they would, I don't know if the primary ones might still be on there, but the geography secondary ones, they seem to be taking some of those down. But they're great if they're still on there, or if you can find them to sit and watch a teacher teaching some geography just to improve your own geography subject knowledge. I know our trainee teachers, some of them, if they're about to teach a subject that isn't their degree subject, will go and do a subject knowledge enhancement course, an SKE. Obviously it has to be paid for, but if your school can fund it, that's another way around improving your subject knowledge. And you can kind of do, you know, 6, 8 or 12 week stints there, depending on what your need is. So, I mean, obviously Twitter, or X as we're calling it now, you know, start following some of us geographers on there, because we're actually a very, very strong community. There's people on there that will happily share things, you know, for free. There's TES as well, isn't there? But a lot of that's paid for now, but there's some free stuff on there. So there is a vast array. I think there's ways and means. It's just, I guess, finding the time, isn't it? You know, teachers are not particularly blessed with a lot of time in their roles and in their lives, unfortunately. But there's a lot out there.
I mean, that's a treasure chest you've just given. I'm particularly interested in the RGS and their Monday night lectures.
Yeah.
It's totally the kind of thing that a school could pay for, even if it's just a geography lead to start off with. But I know my old school, they paid for the membership to the Historical Society, the Geographical Society, and then obviously you get the podcasts and things out there that you get as a result of that.
There's actually, I've just jogged, my own memory has just been jogged. Time for Geography, which is it's an organization/website which has a vast array of geography videos, which are perfect for classroom use. They won a lot of awards last Easter at the most recent Geographical Association for the work that they've done to support schools. Time for Geography, if you have a look at those, they're amazing. They've got a lot of great stuff on there.
Awesome, sounds great. And I think the Oak stuff, if it is down, will probably go back up in a different form, but there are lots of teachers watching that as a vehicle for professional development during the
I've used it for my RE teaching, I don't mind admitting. So for me, learning a new subject, it's been invaluable. Yeah, really good.
Nice. My youngest was actually taught geography today, because I asked him what he did at school, and he said, oh, we did geography, and he went through the things he was doing. I was like, wow, if I were teaching year 2 geography, I would need to
brush up. Wow, amazing. It's great that he recognized it as being geography, because obviously a lot of the time things are looked at through topic work, aren't they? So that's good. It was made explicit that this is geography that you're doing right now. Good.
Yeah, it's the first thing he said. And I was expecting to hear a list of countries and stuff like that there. But
yeah, that's it, isn't it? That's the old Capes and Bays geography. That's, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, that would have been what it was. But no, what did he do out of interest?
He was talking about human and physical features. And so he was talking to me about growth.
Oh, amazing. Wow, that sounds quite highbrow for year 2. Fantastic.
And what role does cognitive science have in this respect, in respect to your guiding principles?
Yeah, I mean, for me, Rosenshine's principles have been invaluable for teaching whichever subject I happen to be teaching. So, I mean, for me, I start every lesson with some sort of starter retrieval activity, because I want to know what they've understood and gleaned meaning from my previous lessons. That if they haven't got to that level of understanding, there's no point in me moving on to the next subject, because we know that our mental map, our internal mental map, our schema is built on gradually over time. And so there's no point introducing new concepts until they are secure in the previous concept. So I would always start with some sort of retrieval. For me, how that looks is the children come in silence. They've got mini whiteboard packs in front of them. There's some questions on the board. They take 2, 3, 4 minutes to just write the answers down. They hold them up. That instantly allows me to see inside their brains. And I tell them that's the phrase I use. You know, it helps me see, okay, who's got it? Who hasn't? Is this a class-wide thing? Is it just one or two students that I can check in on a little bit later? You know, for example, if I'm about to teach six-figure grid references, there is zero point me starting doing that if they are not securing four-figure grid references first, because one leads into the other. So if I put some questions on the board to test them on that and I get a sea of wrong answers, forget the six-figure grid reference lesson. We need to do four-figure. We need to practice that a bit more. So that checking for understanding and checking for meaning is crucial. Then again, as Rosalind Shine said, you know, inputting new knowledge, breaking it down into small chunks. So for example, today, we're looking at the local area with my year nines and looking at the physical reasons why the site for Reigate was chosen. So we looked at four key factors. So Rosalind Shine says that when you teach new concepts, you should break them down into manageable chunks and check for understanding before moving on. So I today broke down those four key reasons that help us understand why Reigate was built, where it was, one at a time, check for understanding, use questioning, mini whiteboards held up to check, you know, that they've got it, do something with it, write something down that demonstrates you've understood it. Then we move on to the second reason and so on, then the third and then the fourth. You know, before I was interested in cognitive science, how I would have taught that would have been, I'd have done all four reasons in one go. And I'd have said, off you go, children, here's some tasks. You've got 10 or 15 minutes, off you go. And you can guarantee, hands up, miss, I'm not sure what I'm doing. I've forgotten what you said for the first one. Can you go back over it, please? So that whole idea of chunking down your information works really well in geography, because certainly for human geography, quite often you're breaking things down into, you know, contributing factors that have led to a certain event. If you throw it all at them at once, it's going to overload their working memory. So chunking it down, I found in geography, works really, really well. Modeling under the visualizer is incredibly useful in geography. There's not a lesson goes by now that I don't use it. Today, for example, with the same class, I had an ordnance survey map of Reigate under the visualizer. They had their copy. I was able to point on my copy, which they could then see on the big screen. So it meant there was no confusion about exactly where they should be looking on their maps. It's just those little quick wins that mean that you're not wasting time, you know, circulating round and making sure that they're on board with you that way. And then a bit of deliberate practice at the end of it. So whether it be a piece of writing or completing some sort of worked example, you know, a maths question, if that's what you're doing. And then I'm very keen to circulate around and check for understanding and address any misconceptions. If I'm seeing that lots of students are making the same mistakes, I'll stop them. I'll reteach it. Again, there's no point letting them persevere with something that they haven't quite got. And then giving regular feedback and timely feedback, which again is something that Rosalind Shine spoke about, and how that looks in my classroom, or how it used to look until about 5 or 6 years ago, when we as a school dropped written marking, was that we'd take the books in once every 2 weeks, and it might be 2 weeks since the students did a particular piece of work. We give them some generic written marking, you know, way after the moment's passed. They read it, they're not making much sense of it, and they make the same mistakes again 2 weeks later. So that's gone now at Reigate School. Feedback, as much as we can do, is in the moment. So one that works particularly well in geography is live marking under the visualizer. So I'll ask for a student to volunteer their book. It goes under the visualizer. Students have their pens down, attention is on the board. That's all they're doing, because what they attend to is what they understand and learn. And I live mark the piece of work in front of them. I might invite the students to help me with that, to tell me what they're thinking about, what they're seeing as well. And then they get dedicated time to improve their piece of work in light of what they've seen me do on the board with that particular piece of work from that student. I think it's Dylan William that says that feedback, oh crikey, I can't remember the phrase now. No, it's gone, but it's what the students do with it that moves them on. It's not about improving that piece of work. I think you said it's about improving them as learners and improving them as geographers, so that next time they attempt a similar piece of work, they can do so with better outcomes. It's something about the quote I'm thinking of. It's more important. You've got to focus on the recipient. No, the recipient should be doing all of the work and not the donor. So in other words, the student should be doing the heavy lifting and the hard thinking, not the teacher. You're kind of just facilitating that hard thinking. So I guess, you know, Rosalind Shine for me has just been revolutionary, because I think it makes sense for all subjects, but it looks different for all subjects, doesn't it? But in terms of geography, it's allowed me to cut out the nonsense as well. You know, the scavenger hunts and the the sticking of clues under students' desks as they come in, and they have to unpeel it and they have to guess what the lesson's about, and just, what, why did we do that? What a waste of time. Just tell them what the lesson's about and get on with it. So it's allowed me to strip that back as well and just kind of get on with the common sense, you know, everyday teaching that's going to actually lead to learning.
It sounds like it's had an impact, or has an impact, on both the large scale and the small scale, like so in the classroom, yeah, but also across your decision making when you're, I don't know, designing your curricula.
Yes, completely. Yeah. I mean, it kind of, it focuses, you know, the sequencing, doesn't it? You know, so when are they first going to meet that concept? When are they going to revisit it? When are they going to revisit it again? And is that level of detail and complexity going to increase over time? So the idea of a spiral curriculum that you're constantly coming back to concepts from year 7 through to year 11. Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Nice. I mean, that'll be massively helpful to anyone who's wrestling with curricula at this point. You're thinking,
well, I think, I mean, in geography, there's certain, I think you're going to ask me about this in a minute, but I mean, there's certain kind of what we might call synoptic links that feed through geography. So, you know, the idea of sustainability and climate change, that pretty much crops up in every topic. The idea that some countries are more developed than others, you know, if you haven't got that basic understanding that not everywhere is as wealthy as the UK, you're going to come a cropper then with a lot of geography teaching. You know, so just ideally feeding those concepts throughout lots and lots of different topics is going to really allow that to be embedded in students' understanding.
I remember when I started teaching, having to put maps on the overhead projector, the visualizer must have massively revolutionized that.
Oh, drawing the acetates, you mean, and then yes, putting those. Yeah, when I did my training, it was all about the OHP and the acetates. I used to spend, because there was no internet when I was doing it, so you couldn't just Google image a map and stick it on a PowerPoint. You had to draw it from scratch, or find one in a book, photocopy it, cut it out, stick it on your worksheet with a glue stick. It's just, yeah, it's another world now, isn't it? Incredible. Yeah. Or draw it by hand on your board before the lesson.
Yeah, I mean, my handwriting was shocking. So, and then I would smudge it with my hand as I was going.
Yes.
So it was never my strong point.
Yeah, I've still got them. I'm looking at it now. I've got a massive ring binder up there, circa 1996, 1997, and it's full of acetates and lesson plans. God, I shudder to think what else is in there, and a whole load of other nonsense. But yeah, I can't part with them because it's kind of like a period in history, isn't it? Educational history.
What sort of visualizer do you guys have?
So in my classroom, I've got the Epivo, isn't it? They're decent, actually. I do like those. I find them really good quality. They've got the self-focusing button as well. Most of our classrooms, having said that, have got the Hue, which are great, but you do have to twist the kind of end part, whatever the technical term for that is, to get it to focus. And every time you move it, it's out of focus. You've got to kind of refocus it. But they're all great. But I do love my Epivo, I must admit, just for that self-focusing button that just makes your life so much easier. It's a nice sharp picture, actually. Yeah.
They're becoming more and more prevalent. And budget is often the thing, the sticking point. So I always tell people, I've got a Hue on my desk now, 20 quid from Amazon. It's a start. And then the more part of your practice it becomes, then the school can possibly say, oh, actually, let's invest in some really, you know, high quality.
Yeah, I don't know what our science department have huge great things. They're huge. I don't know what make they are, but they've got multiple buttons and they're massive. I think because they're doing kind of, you know, they're doing science experiments underneath it, and they need a really, really decent image there. So that possibly might be why. But yeah, you're right. You can pay a variety of prices, can't you? There's a variety of quality and prices out there. Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if they're making things microscopic or looking at microscopic images. I don't know.
Might be right. Just really, magnet. They might have a magnifying glass element to it, possibly. Yeah.
Don't know. I've never heard of them, but I'm going to have to go and look. And
I'll have a look and I'll let you know what make they are.
Now, the next question is the one I've been looking forward to asking the most, because it's the one I'm pretty sure I don't know the answer to this. What is field work?
Okay, so I'm going to quote Mark Enser here, who's the current subject lead for Ofsted for geography. But in his book, Powerful Geography, he's quite keen to draw the distinction between field trips and field work. So field trips is, you know, everyone gets on the bus and they trot off to the museum and they have a great day and, you know, they make new friends and it's great fun. They might not learn huge amounts, but they've had a nice trip out. But field work is a much more focused activity where you're going with a distinct focus in mind and purpose in mind. And it's something that is going to support the curriculum that the students have been studying. So, you know, at its most basic, yes, it might be just to expose students to another location, you know, to inspire that awe and wonder. I remember one of my standout moments from my career was spending the day with a few other geography teachers at the teacher training or the teacher kind of support centre in the London borough of Barking and Dagenham with a guy called Rex Walford. So if anyone's listening who is a geographer or has any sort of kind of interest in geography, they'll probably know who he is. So he was a very prominent geographer. He's sadly no longer with us, but I got to spend the day with him, and he talked about teachers that he knew that would march children up hills, you know, with a view to doing some really rigorous field work. But before they got on with any of that, he would march them up, he would sit them down, and he would just say to them, just spend a few minutes looking, do nothing else. I just want you to look. And, you know, for most kids, it would be an entirely new experience and location. So I think at its most basic, it's important to get students out to inspire that sense again of awe and wonder and seeing a different locality to their own and widening their horizons, broadening and increasing that level of cultural capital. But if we're really going to get the most out of the day, because let's face it, you know, certainly in a secondary school, getting cover for enough staff to have the correct legal ratios and getting that time to actually take whole cohorts out of a school during the school day, you want to make the most of it, don't you? So if you're going to take students out, then I think the main purpose of fieldwork is that it fits in with your curriculum and they're going to investigate something while they're actually there. So whether it be you know, things like traffic surveys or speaking to people to gauge their opinion, environmental quality surveys, looking at, you know, the impact of something, but gathering some sort of data, whether it be, you know, field sketches or, as I've said, interviews or their own interpretation of what they're seeing, gathering some sort of data that's going to be of use to them back in the classroom, that supports their learning, fits in with the curriculum, and means that they're going to come up with some sort of conclusion or finding based on what they set out to investigate. I mean, certainly at GCSE, it's a compulsory part now of the GCSE. They have to undertake two very distinct pieces of fieldwork, physical and human, and they're examined on it in the GCSE. They have to memorise quite a bit, actually, of what they've discovered, and they have to write about it in the exam. So I think the fact that it's so prominent in the GCSE, and always has been, but traditionally it was written up as coursework, and that grade was then formed part of their final grade. Now they're examined on it, but it's always been a very crucial part of the GCSE, which I think reflects its importance. I think it's a crucial part of the geography curriculum. You know, if you're going to teach students about a place, then if you can get them to see an example of it, you know, I know there's constraints, money, time, staffing, etc., but getting students out to see what you're teaching them, you know, experiencing it in the real world, I think is just invaluable.
So, I mean, I was going to ask about how we can design effective or impactful.
Yeah.
It feels like if they follow what fieldwork is, then that should automatically lead to effective, you know.
So I think so. But I think it has to be well designed. So, you know, you've only got so many hours in the day. You're taking staff out. So that time is precious. So I think picking your location, that, you know, so, for example, we take our GCSE students to the Battersea redevelopment. You know, they've done amazing things with the power station there and huge amounts of redevelopment. But it fits in perfectly with what we're studying about London in class. So we deliberately pick that location because we can get there and back in the day. We go on the train, actually. But it fits in perfectly with the curriculum. We're not trying to shoehorn something in because we think it would make a great trip, but it's only vaguely related to the curriculum. So I think it's important to pick your location, make sure it's doable in the time that you've got, you know, taking into account any traffic jams or what have you that might occur, but planning very precisely what they're going to be doing while they're there. So not just kind of rocking up and then, you know, just getting them to have a walk around, you know, prepare those resources, take time in the classroom before you get the students out there, so that they know on the day exactly what they're doing. Great example of that is the other place we take our students to for the physical field work from Reigate is we go down to Eastbourne Beach to look at the impact of coastal management and the groins and what have you that have been put in place there. Those beaches are noisy places with the wind and, you know, students quite like kicking stones around and picking the stones up. So we make sure before they go that they have they are 100% secure in knowing what it is they're going to be doing when they get there. There's no point trying to explain it on the day. You're going to be wasting time. You know, there's external factors that mean that they won't be able to hear you or follow you properly. So just planning those activities really well and making sure students are well prepared. It might be, if it's physical field work, that they've got some quite technical equipment to get used to, you know, calipers, for example, measuring the size of pebbles, ranging poles, setting up transects. Practice that in the playground or an outdoor area before you go. That's really important. If you're trying to explain it on the day with the aforementioned noisy waves and wind, you know, you're setting yourself up to fail and you're going to waste time. And then also, at the other end of it, plan what you're going to do when you get back to the classroom. What are you going to do with that data? Are you going to write it up? Are you going to analyze it? Are you going to, how much of that are you going to hand over to the students? How much guidance are you going to give? I mean, there's a whole debate about should fieldwork be student-led, teacher-led. I think until you get to A level, I think making it fairly teacher-led is quite crucial. Students just don't have the experience, you know, to pick their own hypotheses, to set, you know, questions that they want to investigate and fieldwork techniques that they're going to use when they're out in the field. Once you get to A level, it's actually part of the course is that you have to design your own piece of fieldwork, come up with your own hypothesis, pick a topic. But that's the first point where it becomes like that. Prior to that, it's pretty much teacher led, because otherwise it's going to be a wasted opportunity, I think, if you're just handing it over to the students that much.
That to me feels like the threshold for expertise. You know, we talk about novice and expert.
Yeah.
It's probably when you're starting to study at A level that you should be given a little bit more freedom, I think, Ian.
Yeah. I mean, you literally, you know, you're saying to the students, you know, decide what element of this course you're enduring the most, have a look through the textbook, you know, what do you want to investigate? It's got to be, you know, realistic for them. Is there a location within their area that they can get to? And are there things, is there data that could be collected by going to that location? But yeah, it's a big jump actually from GCSE where it's very structured to A-level where it's kind of, right, well, off you go. Here's the basic structure, but this is down to you now. Yeah, and then of course onto degree where it's even more so when you're doing your, you know, your thesis, for example.
Yeah, because ultimately A-level should really prepare you for the level of independence you're going to have at university. Otherwise, you're not going to struggle.
I think from my own experience, the biggest jump was GCSE to A-level. First year degree was very similar to A-level standard. I mean, it did then jump up, but yeah, A-level to degree wasn't a huge amount of difference. It was quite a nice transition.
In terms of primary teachers and primary curriculum, I think you've done a really good job articulating what it is, but also really practical advice that people can then start to hook their own processes onto. You know, so okay, well, I'm arranging this field trip, I'm arranging this field work.
Field work.
You could tell how bad a geography teacher I was in primary school. They're arranging this field work, and then they're thinking, okay, well, what's the purpose? You know, and then you start with that, and then I've made the resources mistake too many times, you know, and then think, should have done this. And like you said, you're saying do it in the playground. So I think massively helpful, because lots of people always talk about field work and they will tend to, if they're engaged, go to things like Mark's book about powerful geography.
Yeah.
But hearing you say that will and describe that, I think will be massively helpful.
Yeah. And also just to add as well, you know, whereabouts in your sequence of your medium term plan, where is that field work going to fall? You know, you don't want to do it too early because it won't make sense to them. You don't want to do it too late necessarily because the moment might have passed and you've covered everything in class, but then you're constrained about, you know, issues linked with the school calendar. You can't go out on this day, you can't go out on that day because there's other events taking place. So it can be tricky to find the right moment. You've got to think about the weather as well. You know, we take our students to Eastbourne in October deliberately because it's not too hot, not too cold. But we've got to think about, well, that's great, but does that fit in with our sequence of our curriculum? Have we taught them enough so that we can get them out? Because October is quite early on in the academic year. Have we covered enough content before we then take them out to go and do that practical field work? So, you know, the timing is quite hard to get right sometimes when there's all those things to think about.
Yeah, I can imagine. And with the cost of coaches and things like that, there, you can't make the wrong choice.
We're lucky our school cover that. Because coaches are just getting stupidly expensive, aren't they, with the cost of fuel and everything. But I don't think every school is doing that. So I think when we recruit students for the GCSE course, we make it very clear that these two pieces of field work are compulsory. The head teacher actually has to sign something to say that students went on that trip as part of the course requirements.
Like you say, cost of fuel, cost of coaches seems to be going. Sky high. But I mean, the trade seems to be
Absolutely.
okay, though, because you guys say you get in trade in London. Sometimes under 16s get on for a quid or something like that
I
there.
think,
That's nice.
yes. And so we take them, I think, in year, well, this year we're taking them in year 9, so they will be 13 and 14. So we're in that age bracket, certainly, for that one. But I mean, that comes with its own issues, because you're taking students on a public train with members of the public, and that's a whole different ball game to putting them on a coach. That's quite hard work. Just the logistics of having certain members of staff per coach, and making sure no children get off at the wrong stop, and make sure they get on the train as well. That's quite hard work.
For all of you Kofi, Kofi, Kofufu, however you pronounce it, you damn lovely supporters. It's a song going out to you, to you. Nikki Anna P. Seth D. Stephanie Taylor, Mrs. B. S. Atea, Adam, Katie, Lived MC. Becca, Jenfred, Susie, Brown, and Cio, Nechio, Rachel, I am Al, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington. Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, LJ. And last but not least, my lovely little Amy Bill. So they help us pay the bills. A massive thank you out to Dabbe family. Kofi supporters help us keeping it ad free. There's far more content coming just round the bend. Thank you all for helping our very special friends. Friends. Very special friends.
Now, when I talk to secondary colleagues who teach maths, there are certain things they wish perhaps weren't covered in the English National Curriculum.
Yeah.
And when we spoke, you told me you had a considerable number of feeder schools.
We do. I think I might have quoted something like 30. I mean, don't quote me on that, but I know it's a lot. But when I say 30, I think it's the case that we have quite a few children where they're the only one that's come from that school. So, some from kind of, up in Croydon, for example, or down in Crawley, but the majority are coming from a smaller number. But we do have individuals from further afield, from that just have come on their own with no friends.
So obviously they're coming in with a range of knowledge. They've been taught in a range of different ways.
Yeah.
If you could have a basic level of understanding of geography across every pupil coming in from primary, what would it look like?
I think it would be great if they came to us knowing what is meant by human and physical geography, because we do cover that early on, and it's revisited at GCSE. It's how the first two exam papers are split, as a physical paper and a human paper. So them knowing that there are two aspects to geography would be great. Having a basic grasp of map skills as well. So although we cover that across Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4, it'd be great if it was more a case of kind of revisiting and recapping rather than teaching that from scratch. That said, some of them do things like scouts and girl guides and sea cadets. And so they cover that in those, those pursuits as well. So for that reason as well, you can often find different levels of skill and knowledge. I referred to those synoptic links a while back. It would be amazing if students could come to us with a kind of basic grasp of some of those synoptic links. So an understanding of what we mean by sustainability linked with the concept of climate change, because I don't think there's any topic we don't teach now where that isn't relevant in some way, shape or form. The concept of different levels of development between countries. So, we're a higher income country. There are countries around the world that we would class as lower income countries. Having that knowledge that not every country is of the same level of affluence, for example, that we are, that would be really, really useful, because then when we teach concepts linked with globalization, it would make just that little bit more sense to them. So, yeah, I think having the threshold concepts, knowing what we mean by physical, human, possibly environmental geography, having those basic skills, map skills. I think also just the ability to write good quality geography answers, kind of it being a bit more natural to them to make liberal use of key terms. If I've taught them some key terms, I want to see them in your written answer. Even basic things like capital letters for place names and being able to develop their points rather than kind of writing just a list of concepts. you know, phrases like this means that, or this leads to, or as a consequence. Those linking phrases are, they open doors for students. That kind of takes you from a kind of low geography GCSE grade to a much higher one, because you're able to develop your points much, much more. So, you know, we try and get them to do that from year seven. But if they came to us with that skill already, you know, we could build on it even further and outcomes could be even greater at GCSE.
Yeah, and I think that's a conversation about the way we approach the teaching of writing and the purpose of writing, I think, in primary, which is a conversation we're always having on the podcast, because we're very much of the opinion that we could be a lot more specific.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, the extended writing skill isn't just pertinent to geography. You know, I'm trying to get them to do it in RE. I know English, history as well. There's a lot of subjects where there's a lot of crossover. You know, we use Peel paragraphs. I don't know if that means anything to you, but, you know, point, evidence, explain, and then link back to the question. And we start that in year seven and we embed that all the way through to the end of year 11, because essentially if they can do some, you know, great structured Peel paragraphs in those higher mark questions at GCSE, that's going to open up the top grades for them, obviously, along with, you know, littering their answers with key terms as well, and, you know, putting real life examples in there. But just, yeah, being able to write and, I guess, speak like geographers, which we try and model as much as we can, you know, don't get me wrong. But if they came to us already with that basic grasp, then we could really build on things just from the start in year seven.
Either you could either go one or two ways. You could be either not very interested in geography and be the geography lead and think, well, let's just do the bare minimum. Or you can be so interested in geography that you go way beyond.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's about finding the happy medium. Here are the fundamentals that these kids need to know, I think.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've had a look at the Key Stage 2 curriculum and there's a lot in there. It is quite, you know, when I used to do my sessions with the trainee geography teachers, and the first session would be, let's have a look at the Key Stage 2, 3, 4 national curricula. And they're, you know, the trainees are quite surprised at how in depth it is, the Key Stage 2. There's a lot of rigorous geography in there, you know, from a very, very young age, which is great to see. You know, I love my subject. I like to see it having that prominence at primary level as well.
And it is a fascinating subject. I mean, it's one that I've sort of gained an interest in as I've got older, probably thanks to Tim Marshall.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Book. Yes, his books. Yeah, he's got a third one coming out, hasn't he? I can't think what it's called.
He seems to be perpetually writing books.
He's just font of all knowledge. I've got the first two. I haven't read them. It's one of those ones that I've got so many books on the go linked with geography and cognitive science that I can't finish one before starting another because I'm too impatient to start the next one. So, which one is it? It's Powerful Geography. I'm partway through, but it's fascinating reading about, you know, the history of Australia and how it's come to be and how it is like it is today. So much, you know, dare I say, so much history in geography, because there is a bit of a rivalry between the two humanities, but you can't really look at one without the other. So yeah, the geographical history of countries is fascinating as well to look at. Yeah.
I think we're at risk of going off for an additional 2 hours.
It's because I'm talking about geography. I did tell you it was my passion. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and it's fascinating, like I say, and to hear you talking with such passion, I'm all like, yeah, let's just do two more.
I had a full 5-period teaching day today as well, and I'm still going, so.
Yeah, I'm on day with 5 periods, you know, I massively appreciate you giving up your evening.
It's a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
I mean, hopefully you've enjoyed it enough that you'll come back and maybe talk with some primary teachers.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, completely.
Lead geography and that kind of thing.
Yeah, completely. Absolutely.
All I said to do is say thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.